Bibles to Genesis chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37. I want to study for a few minutes tonight a man who truly was one of the greatest men in history. He didn't slay a giant. He didn't work any miracles, so far as we can tell. But he was a man who seized the opportunities that God put in front of him. And I want to emphasize, I want you to think as we go through this lesson, as we talk about Joseph's life and all the things that he faced, you're probably familiar with many, if not all of them, and ask yourself two things. Okay, number one, what would I have done in that situation? And I'm not saying that just to make us feel bad, because it's easy for us to put ourselves down. That's not what's intended. Be honest. You probably have some qualities that which you might make some of the same decisions Joseph made. But the second question I want you to ask is, what opportunities am I missing in my life now? I think there are a lot of great lessons that you can learn in the life of Joseph. I've divided his life into four phases we'll talk about, and some of the lessons that we'll learn in each part of his life. Each phase had new problems, new difficulties that he could not possibly have imagined. They sometimes say the truth is stranger than fiction. I don't think you could have made the story up. How Joseph handled these problems teaches us some wonderful lessons. First of all, the first section of his life, obviously from his birth to the time that he was separated from his parents, David suffered a lot of misfortunes in his father's home. Joseph was a victim of circumstances beyond his control in each segment of his life. I want you to think about that, because we live in a society that values somehow, it's an esoteric value, fairness above anything. And fairness is important. We need to do our best to be fair toward others, maybe even go the second mile to make sure we're not mistreating or being unfair to the other person. But we need to also recognize that fairness is not always going to be achieved, and we should not allow ourselves to run off the rail when we see when we're mistreated. In chapter 37, verse 3, it said, "Now Israel," another name for Jacob, "Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors." Jacob was the victim in his home, in his parents' home, of partiality. His mother, Rebekah, favored him. His father, Isaac, favored Esau. And it set up one of the greatest sibling rivalries you'll read about in history. It is a sibling rivalry that still boils over in the Middle East today. Esau and Jacob. It seemed like he could have learned the lessons from this, but instead he exercises favor in his home. He exercised favor of Rachel over Leah, and now Rachel's child, he exercises favor over all the other sons that he had. He made him a tunic of many colors. Now, color was something that was very expensive, wasn't something that was afforded very many people, and it certainly set Joseph apart in many ways. And I really don't know what kind of son, little boy, Joseph was. Could it be possible that Joseph was of an obedient child? One who respected his father and looked up to him and valued him and wanted to be around him. And he didn't sneak off to do things that he knew his father would disapprove of. He didn't entertain that. It seems that a lot of times in a family, you might have children that are very different. Some that just don't seem to give you any trouble at all. And you have to be very careful, because partiality is a bad thing. First of all, partiality is not a quality that God exercises. We're told in Acts 10 that God shows no partiality. But in every nation, those who come to Him and will live righteously can be faithful and can be accepted by Him. Peter was telling Cornelius, a Gentile, that God is not partial. So we need to understand and appreciate that impartiality It's good. Now, I know we like it when we receive certain affections from people. Not that we necessarily want more affection than they would give other people, but we just appreciate that affection. And sometimes we think of impartiality as being without affection. That's not necessarily so. We can be equally partial to our children and show them great love, and we should. But we should strive to be impartial with our children and to try to be fair with all of our children. It's difficult for me to believe that Joseph didn't know better, that the partiality he demonstrated to Joseph would result in the jealousy of his brother. In fact, it says in the next verse, verse 4, when his brothers saw that their father had loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. One of the greatest lessons that we can get from this in this part of Joseph's life is how dangerous ignoring a problem in the home can be. How it can warp a child's sense of reality and how it can warp a child's sense of how things ought to be. It's sad that there are many children in the world that don't know the value of a loving father at home because dad's nowhere to be seen. Or a loving mother at home because there are women who abandon their children and their families. It's sad that children don't know the value of chores and things that sometimes have gone away in so many families because of our prosperity and the things that we have. We need to understand how important it is as parents not to live in denial about a certain circumstance, but to figure out how we can address it in a godly way. God's Word will give us help, and good brothers and sisters in Christ who've been through the same kind of problem we may be facing with our children can help as well. But Jacob buried his head in the sand. And you add to that circumstance certain dreams that Joseph had in the home. He had two dreams. One, that in his first dream, he and his brothers were binding sheaves of wheat. And Joseph told his brothers this. He said that my sheaf of wheat stood up and all of your sheaves of wheat bowed down to it. And then another dream, and he told this to his entire family, that the sun, the moon, and all the stars, and 11 stars bowed down to him. And it wasn't lost on his father. Jacob ridiculed him and made fun of him and said, "You think I'm going to bow down to you?" So Joseph had that kind of problem, but the dreams were not of his making. He did have the choice, as far as we know. Nothing is said that God instructed him to tell these dreams. And certainly we can learn a lesson that is true, whether it applies in this case exactly or not, that sometimes it's better to be quiet about the things that happen to you. You don't have to reveal everything. Some of us are real good about telling on ourselves about everything that we do. And I guess that might be harmless in some ways. There's nothing wrong with honesty. In a marriage, for instance, there shouldn't be secrets that we know that I'm keeping from my wife, and I know she would be hurt to find out that I'm keeping them. Shouldn't be no secrets of that kind. Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 12 says, "He who is devoid of wisdom despises his neighbor, but a man of understanding holds his peace. A talebearer reveals secrets, but he who is of a faithful spirit conceals a matter." That's an important question, because the Bible says if a man wants friends, he has to be friendly. And one of the charges of a friend or in any relationship where trust is a part, a marriage or a mother-child, father-child relationship, where trust is important, we have to be able to conceal a matter. You make a promise not to say anything, and be careful before you make that promise. Someone says, "Can I tell you something?" But you can't, got a promise. You can't tell anybody. Be careful. Be careful about agreeing to that promise. Because if they say, you know, "I'm going to shoot the president," or "I'm going to go out and rob a bank tomorrow," well, you're going to have to do something about that, okay? And there may be circumstances in which we make a promise and which we may have to asks for the forgiveness, but we're not going to be able to keep that promise. And we're going to have to tell the person that it's owed. So be careful about making that promise. But we need to be able, when a confidence is asked and we give that confidence and it is something that is just between this person and they wanted to reveal this to me, doesn't have to go any further. Nobody's in danger of being killed. And we promise to keep that. I don't care how juicy it is. I don't care how much another person would love to hear it. And I know we get in quandaries sometimes because the person reveals a problem that they're facing with another person, and we try to figure out how we can intervene and make matters better. Pray long and hard about that. Sometimes it's better to let people work their problems out. Sometimes it's not my business, even if someone confided in me. So be careful about those things. But Joseph revealed his dreams. Not the wisest thing. It created a greater hatred of him by his brothers. It estranged him to some degree from his father, who had favored him as he made fun of him. So one day Jacob sent Joseph down to check on his brothers who were tending sheep many miles from home. And they said, as they saw Joseph walking up, here comes that dreamer. They hadn't forgotten. It had so dominated their thought. It had come to define their relationship with him. He's this dreamer who thinks he's so much better than anybody else. And I tell you, that's a difficult place to put yourself in. Whether it is because, what is it, your own fault or not, whenever you give people the impression that you think you're better than they are, that's just about one of the worst things you can do for your relationship with that person. Now, I'm not suggesting that we have false humility or anything like that. I think we should be humble, but I think that we should be truthful. And if someone thinks badly of us because of that, then that'll just have to be. But we don't need to put ourselves in a position. Paul talks about in the early verses of Romans chapter 12, starting about verse 3, that a man ought not to think of himself above what is appropriate. And God's word teaches Jesus was not a man who came to be served, but he came to serve us and our needs. And he certainly did by dying on the cross. But here comes that dreamer. And the brothers grabbed him and threw him in a pit, and they were going to kill him. Judah was determined to kill him, and Reuben decided that he would intervene for the boy. And so he spoke and talked them out of killing him. And Reuben seemed to be away from the group, maybe with the sheep, I don't know. But then some Ishmaelite traders came by looking for slaves. And there's Joseph in a pit, and they sold him for 20 pieces of silver. A sad figure. I don't know how that compared to their daily wage, but whatever it is, you'd be shocked at what little sum people will take in our society today to kill a man. A few hundred dollars is all a man's life is worth sometimes. We need to recognize how precious life is. But they didn't, and they sold him, and they had a problem what they're going to do with their father. So they dipped his coat in the blood of an animal, and they took it to their father and let him draw the conclusions that he was set upon by a lion or something like that and devoured. And so nothing is left but the coat of bloody coat of many colors. And he was a sad man. He knew that this would take him closer to the grave in his sadness. The sorrow would shorten his life to some degree. And so Joseph is taken to Egypt, and he's sold to a man named Potiphar, and he begins to work in that house. I guess this is another phase of his life. I would call this strength in adversity. He has more problems to face. Now, don't you think about this. None of us here have any experience or can probably even appreciate fully what it means to be a slave. You have no rights. You have no hope for anything better in the future. Your life is determined by your master. He can have you put to death if he so chooses. If you become unprofitable to him, he might sell you, or if you become unprofitable enough, he might put you in prison or kill you. And so they saw, as he rides down to Egypt over the days, perhaps week or two, that it would take to get down there. And I don't know the route of the caravan. It may have taken longer than that. Joseph has to size up what his life's going to be like from now on. And one of the things Joseph does that is a great lesson for us is he decides he's going to make the best of his circumstances. In fact, that's a description you could make of Joseph's life from start to finish. He's going to make the best of whatever situation he's put in. Now, I know that we wonder from time to time why bad things happen to good people. And I'm sure that I can't answer that question to all of our likes. In other words, I can't answer that question so that we're okay with whatever future problems we face. We'll face other problems and we'll wonder why. We may recognize that it's not really appropriate for us to look to God and say, why me? Because, you know, God's been good to me. I suspect God's been good to you. God has granted you blessings. Now, can you say that if God granted you no more blessings, that you still have been blessed sufficient for your life? I think most of us probably can. We've been blessed so well with the things that we need, with so many things that are beyond just what we need, with so many things that we want to make. Life is not just a continuation of days. It is rich and is deep. And there are many occasions that we can fondly remember about because of the blessings God's given us. Love, family, people that would give us the shirt off their back and do anything for us. These are precious possessions of life. But we do hope for blessings tomorrow. We do hope for freedom. We do hope for things that Joseph at this time of his life had no more hope for. So he's a slave in Potiphar's house. He's far away from home and the protection of family or friends or anybody that cared about him. Nobody's going to ride up and come to his rescue. I hear about children who are kidnapped and kept as a captive for a long time. And they think about, you know, what it's going to be like when their family comes to them. And they know that the police is probably looking for them all over the place. And they just know any time that he's going to come, that the police are going to come and take that child home. Children have told these stories of how they feel. It's a very common thread. And it is sad to think about the fact that month after month, sometimes year after year, in some cases that we've known, that no one ever came. That's how Joseph felt. No one would ever come. And he knew that. He must have known that. But Joseph determined to make the best. So he works hard in Potiphar's house. Look at chapter 39 and the first verse. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was successful. He was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had that the Lord blessed the Egyptian house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. What a bond that describes. I don't know, Joseph was a young man, and in some ways Potiphar became a replacement father, I guess, to some degree, a figure in some ways. So Joseph found favor with him, and he was made head of the house. And here again, Joseph becomes a victim of circumstances beyond his control. Joseph was a very good-looking man, and Potiphar's wife looked his way and decided that she wanted to have a physical, sexual relationship with him. Look at verse 7. And it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in his house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? You have to admire a young man like that. This didn't just happen once or twice. It happened repeatedly, day after day. Verse 10 says, "So it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her." I wonder what Joseph's story would have been like had he yielded. I suspect we would not have heard of his name. He would be like so many young men, even in our culture today, who give in at the first opportunity to sin, not thinking about the future or the regrets of the future. It's just something that if we can, as older people, I mean, even from, I'm talking about 30 on, can talk about, can emphasize to young people who are yet to face many of these problems, how important regrets are. And how what we would give if we could go back and re-choose some of our choices in our younger age. And those regrets are stronger than the joys or the thrills we received from the sinful things we did. Joseph knew his sin was against God. All sin is against God. So every time I'm in a circumstance in which I have to make a choice, can't emphasize this too much, God's involved in that. You know, nobody might know. It's amazing how we think we can do things and nobody knows. A great example of this is the internet. We get on our keyboard and we type something to a friend, or we send a picture out or something like that, and we think nobody's going to know. Well, it's the internet. Everybody has access to everything. And there be people who may even accidentally, well, as long as nobody I really know finds out about it, then I'm okay. Well, someone you really know already knows, and that's God. God's involved in all of our life. God gave us life, and He's blessed us since. He gave His Son on the cross. He's demonstrated how much He cares about us, and He cares about every choice we make. Now, we may fall trapped to sin, but how much worse are the sins that we premeditate and we arrange a circumstance to be in a place with people we ought not to be with, where they're doing things we ought not to do, and we accidentally sin? We need to understand how foolish that is. God knows better than that, even though we sometimes don't. You don't always know the end of the things that you try and you start. God does know the end of the sins and the types of conducts that we may get into. Look at Proverbs chapter 7. Proverbs chapter 7. Keep your finger in Genesis. We'll come back to that in a minute. Proverb writer talks about how seductive it can be sometimes, and how dangerous it can be for us to listen to the sins of the world. And this is not just talking about a harlot, but that characterizes all sins. It says in verse 4, "Say to wisdom, you are my sister, and call understanding your nearest kin, that they may keep you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. For at the window of my house I looked through my lattice and saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths a young man devoid of understanding, passing along the street near her corner. And he took the path to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. She was loud and rebellious. Her feet would not stay at home. At times she was outside, at times in the open square, lurking at every corner. So she caught him and kissed him with an impudent face, and she said to him, 'I have peace offerings with me. Today I have paid my vows. So I came to meet you, diligent to seek your face, and I have found you. I have spread my bed with tapestry, colored coverings of Egyptian linen. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us take our fill of love till morning. Let us delight ourselves with love, for my husband is not at home, and he has gone on a long journey. He has taken a bag of money with him and will come home in the appointed day.' With her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Immediately he went after her, as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as the fool to the correction of the stocks. Till an arrow struck his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare he did not know it would cost his life. Now therefore, listen to me, my children. Pay attention to the words of my mouth. Do not let your heart turn aside to her ways. Do not stray into her paths, for she has cast down many wounded. All who were slain by her were strong men. Her house is the way to hell, descending to the chambers of death. The Bible teaches that there are dangers in life, and we think we can handle them. We think that all the regret won't be too bad. We need to understand that there was strength in this man, Joseph, and he sets an example for us. What decision would you and I make? What opportunities are we missing in our life now to stand up for the Lord in adversity? That's what Joseph did. And so, one day, Potiphar's wife, unsuccessful at seducing Joseph, physically restrained him, and he ran from her, leaving his coat in her hands. And she used this to accuse him of trying to rape her. And so Potiphar took Joseph, accepting his wife's lie as the truth, and cast Joseph in jail. I can only believe that his relationship of trust to Joseph kept him from killing Joseph. But he did put him in jail. And now Joseph is in another circumstance, taken advantage of, not because of his own circumstances, but because of others. He's a victim. The story doesn't stop there. Again, Joseph makes the best of his situation. Now, I know in his father's house, he was a free man. He had a future as a shepherd. He had God's promises, of course, that he, his descendants, would be as the stars of the heaven. He's part of that Hebrew family that God promised Abraham would come about. He then is made a slave. And though he rose in Potiphar's house, he was still a slave. Now he's in a dungeon somewhere. Well, Joseph is trustworthy, is hardworking, dependable, he's willing. And so he rises in the estimation of the jail keeper. And so he is then keeper of the jail. And he, I'm sure, makes the rounds to make sure everybody's where they need to be and has everything they're supposed to get in terms of a meal and everything like that. The jailkeeper trusts him. And by, there were a couple of other inmates that came to know him, a butler and a baker. These were two men who were in Pharaoh's court. And there was some type of a, some scholars believe, it seems that it might have been an assassination attempt. And the butler and the baker were put in prison until the matter could be resolved and they could, Pharaoh could figure out who the guilty party was. These two men by and by had dreams. Each of them had a dream. And they didn't know who could interpret that dream. It just so happened, Joseph speaks up. God has allowed him the ability to interpret dreams. So he interprets their dream. Now, interpretation of the baker's dream is that in 3 days he was going to be hung. Interpretation of the butler's dream, in 3 days he's going to return to service of Pharaoh. And in 3 days the judgment came down, and just as Joseph said, the baker was to be hung, the butler's to be returned to faithful service in Pharaoh's court. And so Joseph had a request of the butler. The baker's gone, he's going to be hung. Whether he's truly guilty or not, we don't know. But the baker's going to go back to Pharaoh's service. And he says, when you get to Pharaoh's service, please remember me. What does that mean? He wanted out. Now, don't think that Joseph was just fine being a slave. Just because he made the best of his circumstances didn't mean he didn't want to be free. Now he's in prison. Just because he made the best of his circumstances didn't mean he liked it. He wanted to be free again. And he knew Pharaoh could make that happen. And so he asked the butler a personal favor. Now, I don't know what the butler's estimation of that is. Joseph had been good enough that the butler should have kept his promise. I realize that he likely would have been set free without Joseph's interpretation of his dream. But it had to show him that Joseph was a man of God, because he was able to interpret the dream. But he went back to service in Pharaoh's court, forgot all about Joseph. Well, what a powerful lesson that is. How many promises have you and I forgotten about in our life? We've never been in prison. We've never had a man's life in our hands to fulfill that kind of promise. But there are other promises that we make. We need to keep those promises. We need to be careful about the promises we make so that we will keep the ones, and we can keep the ones we make. In any case, Joseph was forgotten again, and again was a victim of circumstances beyond his control. In Genesis chapter 40 and verse 23, "Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. And it came to pass at the end of 2 full years." So by this time, 2 more years have gone by. Joseph's still in jail. He's still in prison. And he knows now, well, I suppose I'll never get another opportunity because the butler's clearly forgotten about me. But what happened is, Pharaoh had a dream now. And Pharaoh knew and understood these 2 dreams he had were important. And so important that, unlike other dreams he had had in his life, he decided he wanted to find out what they meant. And he called all his wise men together. He said, "I had 2 dreams. There were 7 very fat cows that came up out of the Nile River. And then there were 7 lean cows, skinny cows, that came up and devoured the fat cows. And the skinny cows were no fatter after they devoured the fat cows." He just was certain that there was something about that. I'm not sure that God didn't put that in his heart to know and understand that there was something unique about this dream. And then he woke up in the night and wondered about that and went back to sleep. Had a second dream. There were 7 plump ears of corn. And then there were 7 very withered ears of corn. And then the withered ears of corn ate the 7 plump ears, but they got no fatter as a result of eating those plump ears of corn. What does this mean? And all the wise men in Egypt couldn't, admitted, "We don't know what this means." Then the butler remembered Joseph. And he said, "I know a man who can interpret dreams." He interpreted the dream that I had and that the baker had accurately, both of them. So Pharaoh called Joseph into his presence and he asked for the interpretation of the dream. And of course, Joseph said that the dreams referred to the future in Egypt, that there were going to be 7 years of prosperity in which the harvest was going to be plenteous, the people were going to have plenty to eat, and great prosperity is going to take place in the land. Then that's going to be followed by 7 lean or years of famine. And the 7 years of famine would be greater than the years of prosperity, so that Egypt would fall into poverty as a nation. And he made a proposal. He took the initiative and said what Pharaoh needs to do, and Pharaoh's all ears, because here's a man who's giving this interpretation and he's had the testimony of the butler, whom he probably is very close to at this time. This butler is the man who serves him probably every meal. And he's a trusted man. He may have been cleared, and now the Pharaoh feels bad for putting him in prison to begin with. So he's going to listen to what this man that his trusted butler's testified of has to say. And he says, "You need to save up some of the prosperity of those good 7 years, and then you'll have it later on, and Egypt will be..." And you know what Joseph did for Egypt is something quite remarkable from an economy standpoint. He started what we would call taxation. We may not like him for that reason, but we understand that some taxation is okay and good. Now, the people came and they sold all of their livestock to Pharaoh. Then they sold their land to Pharaoh. Then they sold themselves to Pharaoh. And a concept that started in Egypt with Joseph continued through the feudal years of history. All the kings, the concept was, in every land, owned everything. You may have a farm over there, but really it's the king's land. It's not just your land. And only till America came, really, did we begin to break that concept of everything belonging to royalty. And we live in a land that's very different than that. Joseph started that in Egypt. He made Pharaoh wealthy beyond our imagination, because all the people gave to Pharaoh all that they had so they could eat during those years. In any case, Pharaoh was grateful.
I suspect, we're not told, I suspect that just as God probably put it in the heart of Pharaoh that these dreams were central and important and they did have to do with the future of his nation and his rule, I strongly suspect that God that put it in Pharaoh's heart that Joseph's interpretation was spot on, and that's exactly what he needed to do. Joseph makes a statement to his brothers later on that God had made Joseph like a father to Pharaoh. Some have looked at some of the pharaohs that ruled in Egypt as children, as young boys, and maybe they grew to be older, as possible pharaohs that Joseph served under. But this pharaoh made Joseph the second in the land, and men had to bow down to him just like you bow down to a king. And they had to do everything he said. And just as with Potiphar, just as the prison guard, Pharaoh didn't know about anything regarding his economy, but that Joseph made that decision. And Pharaoh was content if Joseph made that decision. Well, of course, the story doesn't really end there because it didn't start in Egypt. It started in Canaan. And in that famine, it wasn't just a famine in Egypt, it was a famine all over that part of the world. And Jacob knew that they didn't have enough to eat. They weren't going to make it if his sons didn't go down to Egypt and buy some grain. And he sent his brothers down there. Well, of course, they come before Jacob. Jacob recognized them. Why didn't they recognize Jacob? Well, several reasons. Probably as an Egyptian ruler, Jacob probably had, Joseph probably had the Egyptian garb on and maybe even some makeup. The rulers would wear that a lot of times. But even beside that, they could not imagine that Joseph would be here. A man that they would come and bow before? That reminds us of a dream that Joseph had as a boy and told his brothers. And they mocked him and called him a silly dreamer because of it. But that's what the case was. And so he recognized them, but they didn't recognize him. They didn't bring Benjamin, his full brother from his mother and father. And he said, you need to go back and bring Benjamin. Interesting that they left a brother. Was it Simeon or Reuben? I think they left Simeon. In any case, they left as a promise to bring back Benjamin. And they weren't going to bring... Dad was not going to let... Simeon can stay down there in prison. You're not taking Benjamin. And finally, they did. Joseph created a ruse in which they were accused of stealing from the man who was second to Pharaoh. Can you imagine the absolute disbelief that his brothers were as they were sitting in prison, and as the cup, Joseph's cup was taken out of Benjamin's bag, and now they're all in prison. And Reuben said, I told you not to harm the boy. He had not forgotten what they had done when they sold him into slavery. In any case, Joseph brings all the brothers in and he reveals himself to them in the 41st chapter of 45th chapter, rather, Genesis chapter 45. The brothers are pleading, please, we had a brother who was lost and it caused our father such sadness, he's never been the same. And now if you take Benjamin, and we can't take him back, that surely will put our father in the grave. And it demonstrated a change in the brothers. They weren't the same impudent, jealous men that they used to be as boys, as young men. And they were concerned about their father, even though their father had been partial against them. And they didn't like that. You know, it's interesting how children can be. They hated Joseph, but I don't get the impression that they hated their father. You know, I say this to us as parents. God has placed parents in a very powerful position regarding children. It's not something to take for granted. It's not something to treat your children as your own little personal slaves or anything like that, or to take advantage of them, or to certainly create disillusion in them because you aren't honest with them and you aren't caring like a father or mother ought to be, or a grandparent ought to be.
We need to understand that when your child is very small, God has made you almost like God to them. Whatever you say. Oh, you teach them about God, but they don't really have those concepts yet. Whatever you say goes. And that's a powerful place to be. We need to set good examples to our children. Not just in not being partial, but in being godly, being at church every time the doors are open, reading our Bibles every day, studying with our family as we eat supper together at night. These are all little things, but they're things our culture has abandoned many years ago, most of us. And we need to know how precious and special they are. And so he could see that these men had changed. And it's in verse 1, he says, Joseph could not restrain himself before all those who stood by him. And he cried out, make everyone go out from me. So no one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud. And the Egyptians of the house of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Does my father still live? And his brothers could not answer him. They were speechless. They couldn't understand how this could possibly be. They were dismayed in his presence. And Joseph said to his brothers, please come near to me. So they came near. Then he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now, do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. Interesting that Joseph, during all this time, was not saying, why me or poor me? He was looking, not just, you know, he made the best of his situation in Potiphar's house. He made the best of his situation in prison. But all the time, he's making the best of his situation before God. Can we see that here? He was not blind to all the things that were happening to him. He was not so caught up in the partiality that worked against him. He was just looking for his place in service to God. What a powerful, powerful thing. And here we are, without so many of the problems that he faced. Too often, we're not looking for our place in God's kingdom. Our place in service to others. Our place in rearing our children in a godly way. Our place of setting a good example and coming to worship every time we can to worship God because He deserves our worship for all the blessings that He gives us day after day. Don't be grieved, he said, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years the famine has been in the land and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a prosperity for you in the earth, to save your lives by a great deliverance. Now Joseph is not just looking at outside of himself to his family. He's looking at the promised seed that God promised Abraham. He's not just going to deliver Jacob and his sons. He's going to deliver the Hebrew people who would surely have perished had God not made a way and put a man there to help them. And that man, of course, was Joseph. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and Lord to all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Wow. Now this family that is in Canaan, if you remember the story about Jacob, Jacob had problems with people everywhere he went. He had people that would fill in the wells that he dug and take advantage of him and threaten him in various ways. I'm sure Jacob knew that he's not going to be able to provide a way for his sons to live and to prosper in the future. Let me tell you what, the world is out of our hands. Your life is out of your hands. Your children's life, what will that be? Your grandchildren. These are all questions that are too big for us to answer. But God was there for his people to fulfill his promise to Abraham and to provide a way. Jacob was that man. He underwent a lot of problems, but he kept his eye fixed on heaven, kept making the best of his circumstance, and yet he forgave his brothers. He regretted that he didn't have the years with them to enjoy life, to enjoy the love that families have, but he didn't blame them any longer. He knew that this was all part of God's plan. Could we suppose then that if God's plan includes us in some way and these people mistreat us, that that's part of God's plan? Well, no, the mistreatment of us is not part of God's plan, but God will make use of us in spite of that. God will make us instruments of righteousness in spite of that if we'll keep our faith. Be steadfast in adversity. Be faithful in prosperity. And be faithful in our death as well. Look at Genesis chapter 50 and we'll bring our thoughts to a close. As we read about the last words that come out of Joseph's mouth, starting in verse 22, the last chapter of Genesis. So Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household. Joseph lived 110 years. And Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation, the children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, who were brought up on Joseph's knees. And Joseph said to his brethren, I am dying, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you and carry up, and you will carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. He was not put in a tomb. He was not left there. His bones are going to be carried out, just as he promised. And he said, God's going to visit you. Now, you turn the page several hundred years to Moses' time, when the Israelites are crying out to God, you promised to visit us. You see, it was the promise of this man, the prophecy of this man, that so was branded on his children, grandchildren, and his descendants' memory and heart that God was going to visit them to deliver them and take them to a promised land. That was something that became a bit of a lore because Joseph was such a dominant figure in his family. And the Bible says that he didn't just look to the land that he was in for his earthly prosperity, but he looked to another land. A land that is not made with man's hands. A land where all our promises can be fulfilled. How is your service to God tonight? I know we've taken a long time to talk about the life of Joseph. It's a lot. And we've taken kind of a 10,000 foot view. But there's so many great and wonderful lessons for us to think about. God has a plan for you. That's not just a cliche for a preacher to say. God really has a plan for you. A place for you. A service for you. And if you'll make the best of your circumstance in spite of the adversity, even when people mistreat you, if you'll look for God's will, God's opportunities in your life, God will bless you. Joseph, as I said in the introduction, is one of the greatest men on the face of the earth. Though he didn't conquer giants, he didn't conquer cities, he was a great man because he seized opportunity. And what about you now? Is there an opportunity you need to take hold of? As you think about your life, if you're not a Christian and you realize you ought to be, or if you're not faithful to God, you realize you ought to be, it's time that you seize that opportunity to be all that you need to be. You must be for your soul's sake, for all of eternity. Bring your heart to God in service to Him. Won't you come while we stand and while we sing?